You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. The newer your car, the more dangerous it could be. If you're not in a traffic jam already, slow down a bit and ask yourself, who's in control of the car you're driving? If it's one of the newer Audis, Mercedes, Ford or Toyota, or any other with a computer in between you and your accelerator, brakes or steering, your car might decide not to do what you tell it. This week, Ford in Germany announced they've developed a system to predict a crash and intervene. Get the computer to do that, to stop it. But what if the computer intervenes when you don't want it to, or the computer is hacked? As Auto Week magazine does this week, we ask who's really in control of the car you're driving? And was the death of award-winning investigative journalist and author Michael Hastings back in June over in Los Angeles really an accident? Plus, nuclear waste agreements have been rolled over despite failures by the contractors. How can that be safe? And BMW's in the news this week as €7,000 appears in the bank account of Angela Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats, in Germany. And suddenly, hey presto, they block a new emission limits being proposed by the European Union. And as Labour leader Ed Miliband pledges to freeze energy bills, hey presto, again, energy companies put their prices up, and it's us that's going to freeze. Also, Bristol citizens this week turning empty offices into homes, and their plans are rumbling finally into action. But we start this week with energy prices, and I'm joined in the studio by David Powell from Friends of the Earth. Hi, David. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Headline in The Independent this week, fuel price hikes for the winter. Now, I may be cynical, but I am a bit cynical, actually. And I heard a couple of weeks ago Ed Miliband saying, you know what I want to do is I'm going to freeze energy prices. Am I a bit cynical in saying that this is one of the reasons maybe why these prices are going up? Because they're saying, well, look, Ed, you're not in charge, we are. We will put the prices up whenever we want to.
Yeah, who knows what's going on? Well, okay, so let's have a stab at it then, Tony. I think prices were going to go up anyway, because every year, people will know, every year the prices have been going up and up and up and up. So we've had SSE put their prices up by about 8%, British Gas by about 10%, which is 3 and a bit times inflation. And all the other ones will follow suit. So the rest of the big six energy companies, which supply 98% of the electricity that we use, they're all going to follow suit. What we see is one of them raises prices and then the others all follow, which rather suggests that things aren't perhaps operating quite as openly as we might like. Now, whether or not it's an immediate reaction to Ed Miliband's promise to freeze prices, I don't know. But I tell you what, if I was an energy company and I thought my prices were going to be freezed, I'd certainly try and get my prices up as quickly as I could.
Why are we in this situation? And is there any actual way of trying to keep these prices down? I mean, what we keep hearing is that actually it's wholesale prices that are going up.
Yeah, so the main thing that is pushing up energy bills is the cost of the fossil fuels that goes into your energy bills in the first place. And most of your electricity and obviously the gas that fires your heating is fossil fuel. And that's the rise in the price of fossil fuels has been 2/3 responsible for what's happened to bills over the last decade. So that's what's going on. Now, one of the reasons, I suppose, that when one energy company raises its prices, all the other ones do, is because the price of fossil fuels is getting more expensive across the board. And that's because there's more and more people in the world wanting to get their hands on it. And there's only a finite amount of the stuff to go around. So that's really what's going on with prices.
But is there a real market in energy? Because, I mean, you know, there are actually really a handful of massive international energy companies. I mean, I would have thought that it would actually pay them to every once in a while sit around together and say, OK, guys, let's all put the prices up together.
Yeah, well, there is no properly functioning market. Whether or not you can have one, whether you should have one, is another question. I mean, all parties are talking about more competition in the market. Is that really the answer? I don't know. Why is it that the things that we most heavily rely on, where there appears to be, quote, market failure, things like transport, things like energy, things like food, why is it those things that are the most important to people's lives are the ones where we seem to get the biggest market failure? What's really going on? Well, we have a market that doesn't work. We've got 98% of electricity supplied by six massive companies. They generate energy themselves. They sell it to themselves. Some of the parent companies make a massive profit. We're told that the retail companies, the ones that you deal with, only make a small profit. No one really knows what's going on. What is for sure is that people's bills are going through the roof. And the worst thing of all about it, I work for Friends of the Earth. What I'm finding particularly galling is what I see as a deliberate campaign of finger pointing at so-called, quote, green taxes on bills. So if you let me talk about that a little bit, Tony, the green taxes, what that really means, this is support for people to insulate their homes so they don't freeze, so they use less energy. It's support to try to get more renewable energy onto the grid. And it's doing a little bit, and only a little bit, to tax pollution and to stop there being so much carbon being done in the first place. It's 10% of your bill. It's barely rising at the moment. It's certainly nothing compared to fossil fuels. And it's exactly what we need to do to get the sort of investment to protect people and the right energy system that we haven't had for years. What's happening is that that's being fingered and that's being blamed. The real problem is an energy system that's clapped out, over-reliant on fossil fuels and completely opaque to the public.
Well, that's a bit worrying. What's Friends of the Earth's fix? Are there any fixes that you can come up with? Because, I mean, that's what we hope, you know, at those of the few of us out there that pay our Friends of the Earth subscription. You guys have got to actually point the way. How are we going to get through this?
Yeah, that's right. Here's three things that can happen. The first thing is it's a long-term fix, right? This is not a quick win. Long-term, we need to get off fossil fuels. We need to start doing that now. The price of gas, the price of oil, the price of coal are only going to go up and up and up, right? They've been going up steadily for years. All projections say they're going to keep going up. So let's, in the long run, let's get off fossil fuels, and we need to start that investment now, because the quicker we get off, the better. Second thing we need to do is insulate our homes properly. We've got a pathetic national scheme called the Green Deal going on at the moment. It's the only thing that's really out there to help people insulate their homes. You take out a loan at 6 or 7% and you insulate your home when, frankly, it's quite difficult to give insulation away. And 12 people in the whole of the country have actually had work done under this scheme, which was supposed to be the once-in-a-lifetime government policy. Now, I'm not making that number up. The third thing is, all right, let's have a look at these so-called green costs on bills. Let's see if we can't improve them, see if we can't do better policies, and let's see if we can't move them off bills. I don't have a problem with moving them off bills and onto general taxation. I think policies that insulate homes and make our energy system fit for the future are a public good. I think they should be on the tax system. Let's move them off if we're going to do them better and still do them off taxation, but let's not move them off because it gets off the energy company's case. Let's not give the energy companies an easy PR job by doing that. Let's do it because we want to make them decent and because we think paying for energy systems is a public good.
I mean, let's just take coal, for example. I mean, I know it's not the most fashionable fuel out there. In fact, people seem to sort of chain themselves to bulldozers to stop people using coal. Yeah. But there's a lot of it, for example, in South Wales, and it might be actually not so incredibly expensive to get it, especially with modern techniques, which are a lot safer than traditional mining was. Mm. Isn't it feasible to have some kind of nationalised system where actually we're extracting that energy out of the ground at cost, rather than this is going through some sort of, effectively through a cartel, where the cartel is taking their profits, massive profits that they make, far, far bigger than economies that these big energy companies, than individual countries, for example. And also that is not only going to the shareholders and boosting profits of these big companies, it's also going to the bosses. Now, there's a whole boss tier of people on salaries of millions that are taking out of that. Now, if you get rid of all of that and actually start supplying energy at cost, surely the price is going to come down.
So I do think, I mean, I'm not sure, okay, let's deal with that in two bits. I do think we need to radically do energy differently in this country. I think we need to give people control of their energy. I think we need to see people like they do over in Germany, maybe talk about Germany's problems in a minute, but like they do over in Germany, where half of all of the renewable energy in Germany is owned by people. They've got 60 gigawatts of solar and wind power, and it's owned by people, completely bypassing the utilities. Over there, the utilities are in massive trouble. Their fundamental business model of selling centralised fossil fuels to people has gone out the window. People don't want it, and everyone over there is part of that project. Coal, I'm not sure about. Coal is the most polluting fossil fuel. If you want to, we've only got a finite amount of fossil fuel we can possibly burn as a planet if we're to avoid climate change. If you want to burn coal, you can burn less of the other fossil fuels, and really we need to get off all three.
But is it really possible for us to have our own fuel supply with, energy, the solar panels on the roof are just not going to supply enough, David, are they?
So what we need to do is three things concurrently. Renewables can't supply probably all of the energy for the country, not in any sort of meaningful timescale. They can supply an awful lot more than they do now. They need to be balanced by, we think, a little bit of gas. There's a role for a bit of gas on the system. Much better storage, much better linkages up with Europe so that we can swap energy at different times. If the wind is blowing here, it probably isn't blowing somewhere else in Europe. Let's swap energy at different times. And let's use it a lot more sensibly. So 1 in 4 of every pound that you use to heat your home, if you live in an average home in this country, goes straight out the roof because it's not insulated properly, straight out the walls because it's not insulated properly.
Straight out the door, in my case,
straight out the door because you don't shut your door, yeah. So let's do that. Let's think about energy more sensibly. It's a long-term project, but it requires spending money now. What we're doing, unfortunately, if we just left it to the market to try and fix climate change, it wouldn't happen. What we're trying to do is heavily intervene in a market which wants to use fossil fuels because they're cheap, wants to use fossil fuels because they've got all the infrastructure, and we're trying to swerve it round. That's going to cost a bit of money, but we would have to spend some money anyway because the energy companies have not been investing in anything for the last 20 years. They haven't been investing in any sort of power stations in particular, which is the real reason of these worries about the lights going out. It's nothing to do with the sort of energy, it's the fact they haven't been doing it.
How real is that threat? Because we've heard both sides of the argument, haven't we? Some people saying, politicians particularly saying, that there is this serious threat that maybe if it comes to a cold winter, there simply isn't going to be enough power around because of people like you, because of people who are saying that we can't have these coal-fired power stations.
Yeah, so the amount of reserves that we'll have, I think we'll have about 5% spare capacity is what they're predicting we'll be down to, which is what France has got, Belgium's got, I think Ireland has got as well. So it's not exactly a massive reason to panic. And Ofgem, the regulator, say we should be absolutely fine. And I can't help but think that it's coincidental, or maybe it isn't, that in the week in which we're steeling ourselves for the announcement of a phenomenal subsidy for nuclear power, that all of these scare stories are going around about the lights going off. As I said, Tony, the real problem is, there hasn't been enough investment in energy of any sort, green energy or dirty energy. The main problem is that the big six are not fit to invest in the energy systems that we need for the future of this country, and that's the real problem. A few wind turbines on a few hills or out in the sea, or a few solar panels on people's roofs, that's not the reason the energy system's in the state it's in.
Well, you mentioned nuclear there. We've had an announcement that George Osborne's been actually over in China.
Bless him.
Wooing the Chinese, saying, please, can we have a little bit of money to plonk in just down the road from Bridgewater, and so we can have one of our nuclear power stations. Mm. Also, we hear that Areva is to join the Hinkley Point UK nuclear consortium. That's the French group, Areva, yep. Ready to join with EDF-led consortium that plans to build a nuclear power plant at Hinkley Point. That's according to Reuters there, quoting people with knowledge of the matter. So what we've got here is French consortiums. You said that earlier. Yep. It does start to look as if, okay, so the money wasn't available in Britain to do this, but it will be from China. And it does look now start to look as if this is likely to happen, possibly starting next year.
So EDF are the main company behind this. They're French, owned by the French state. As you've said, there's another French company coming on board, Areva, and up to half, maybe even more than half, no one quite knows, of the money for this power station and for future ones will now come from China. And it will be funded by bill payers or taxpayers, depending on how they finally divvy it up. It'll cost $50 billion over a guaranteed 40-year contract. For something that nobody wants really to invest in because the economics don't work. There are no British companies falling over themselves to do this. In fact, they've pulled out of bidding processes earlier on. The main problem with nuclear power is a 60-year-old technology. It's getting more and more expensive, not cheaper, unlike renewable energy, incidentally, which the costs of solar, for example, have come down 70% just in the last 2 years. That's getting cheaper and cheaper. That's the sort of thing, in my opinion, that solar and wind need a bit of a push, need a leg up to get them onto a playing field. But you can see through the subsidies we're giving them how quickly they are coming down in cost. The alternative with nuclear is you've got something that people are uneasy about, which requires a 40-year contract for the economics to work, and which no British company wants to get involved with anyway. that's what we're left with. And the problem for all of this is the finger repeatedly gets pointed at green energy, which actually is limitless and free. Once you've built your wind turbine, the energy from it is free, unlike for nuclear, which requires...
Well, this is the point I'm going to make, because there's subsidies for your lovely green energy too, so why not for nuclear?
So, two entirely different things. So, nuclear has proven that it's very expensive. And what you're doing in subsidising nuclear is you're basically paying... The state is paying money, or you as a bill payer are paying money, to compensate for the fact that otherwise nuclear wouldn't be cost efficient. What you're doing when you're subsidising wind and solar and hydro is you're doing something entirely different. You're saying, at the moment, these things are quite expensive. These are quite expensive technologies because they're brand new, in the same way that if you bought a computer 30 years ago for something with the processing power of your watch, it'll probably cost you £300 or something. What you need to do to get costs down is you need to get loads of them going in. You need to get industry springing up, supply chains, people trained in how to do it, and you get economies of scale, and the sort of thing that you see happening with industries. Things get cheaper, new technology. You need the subsidies to encourage the take-up, to encourage the industry to get that to happen. As soon as you can, you take those subsidies away. The subsidies for wind power last 15 years, for solar panels 20 years, for nuclear 40 years. And also it's worth pointing out that the solar and wind subsidies come down really, really quickly in price. So if you put one in next year, you'll get a lot less. They're doing two entirely different things. So it's worth thinking about that, that what you're doing with nuclear is essentially giving it a check, and in this case, giving the Chinese and the French a check, for £50 billion for 40 years, which, purely from an economic point of view, and I haven't touched on public concerns about the safety and what you do with the waste and all of that sort of thing, is a bit of a liability. And also, when the nuclear power station is all done and dusted, it isn't going to be the French and the Chinese that pay fully to clear it up. That's going to be paid by the government, as it is now. And also, in the event, you know, touch wood, this never happens, or something horrific like Fukushima or something happening over here, the industry only has to bear some of the insurance costs, and the government would step in to sort that out.
So,
as well.
I mean, how can they be actually making a case for getting people to invest in something that, if things go wrong, they don't have to pay for? And also, the clear-up, actually, what they're quite happy to turn Hinkley Point into a nuclear nightmare, you know, with nuclear waste around, but we have to then clear it up. I mean, surely that doesn't actually make sense as a business model.
It makes a lot of sense for EDF and for other investors, because they're being given a check from the government.
How do they manage to convince the government that that's even vaguely viable, if actually what's happening is there's a massive public subsidy going? In fact, it's this, you know, if you're talking about insurance costs, this is an open-ended subsidy.
Okay, so the one thing that nuclear does have going for it is that it is low carbon, and the government is, through the law that it itself supported through the Climate Change Act and through the fact we need to do something about climate change, it wants to reduce its carbon emissions. So that bit of it is probably fair enough. But what's happening is a campaign where people have convinced themselves that because right now renewables can't deliver on the UK's energy needs, that they never will be able to. We've had the example of what we've had with talks about blackouts this week is a real example of the sort of scare stories, the sort of scaremongering that you see. And it's two entirely different ways of thinking about energy, really. Nuclear is about building a few very large centralised power stations, which fits very neatly into the way that people have traditionally, the big energy companies, think about energy, the way the government thinks about energy, which seems to some like a much safer bet than renewables on roofs or around the country, spread out, much more diverse, much more like an ecosystem that's actually much more secure. So I think more than anything else, there's been a massive lobbying exercise, but the economics don't work. The economics have never worked, and the economics are extremely unlikely.
Well, I mean, one of the most horrific things about this, of course, is the waste. I mean, if anyone's stood on Temple Mead Station as one of these nuclear waste trains, these sort of flat, brown railway, I suppose, I don't know what you call them, trucks, whatever they are, with the cream-coloured nuclear flasks on, as it actually goes through the station, you can actually feel the radiation coming off it. I guess it's gamma radiation. I mean, I've stood there on the platform and thought, good God, you can feel the radiation off these things. They are incredibly radioactive. And the waste is one of the big problems. That all goes off up to Sellafield in Cumbria, of course. And we heard Mark Leftley, who was on this show last week, from The Independent, saying, just a week or so ago, a couple of weeks ago, a shock over the new contract for Sellafield companies. Unions and MPs have reacted with shock to yesterday's announcement that the companies, that was on the 5th of October, that have overseen cost overruns and delays in the clean-up of Sellafield have been given a new five-year contracts. Margaret Hodge, chair of the Public Accounts Committee, told The Independent that the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority will have a job justifying the decision to hand Nuclear Management Partners, NMP, a new five-year deal. The consortium made up of Britain's AMEC, URS in America and France's Areva, same firm, were found by the committee to have been behind schedule on 12 out of the 14 projects in Cumbria. So they're behind schedule on 12 of the 14 contracts, that's almost all of them, and yet they've been told, very well done, you can have another contract.
Yeah, and of course up there, I mean, we, so Friends of the Earth is a grassroots organisation across the whole country, and we've got very active campaigners up in the Lake District, Cumbria, near Sellafield, all up there. People don't want this stuff up there either. And there was recently a case where a massive campaign resulted in a particular plan being rejected. So not only is this, the economics of nuclear overrun hugely, two-thirds of the Department of Energy's budget is spent on decommissioning previous and paying for mopping up after previous nuclear plants. The costs always overrun. The costs of nuclear are always overrun. They always go massively over budget, rightly because of concerns over safety, and Fukushima's only increased that. They're more and more expensive to build, and they take longer and longer to build. And then, as you're pointing out, Tony, actually clearing up after them is proving more and more difficult because people don't want them.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, why nuclear still? I mean, it just doesn't seem, the figures don't add up, the environmental issues don't add up, the health issues don't add up, so why this obsession with nuclear?
Well, because it's a vested interest. I mean, in France, for example, they made an executive decision of the dirigiste state in the 60s and 70s that they were going to have a big, state-run nuclear industry. And they've basically chucked so much money at it now that they've got to sell nuclear power on in order to recoup some of the losses. They've addicted themselves to heroin, and now they've got to get other people addicted to heroin,
so
otherwise they can't afford to
David
keep their fix.
What was saying about these other technologies, like wind, solar, these kinds of technologies, is that they've invested so much in developing the ability to actually build a nuclear power station that they've just simply got to carry on.
That was definitely what's pushing EDF, and I imagine the same sort of thing will be going on for the Chinese, but of course the Chinese work within a communist economic context where they can make a loss. I mean, in many ways, actually, the way the Chinese economy works is quite interesting, because their international firms, oil industry firms and so on, can take a very long-term view because they're not being bothered about shareholders breathing down their neck on a quarterly basis. That's actually quite an interesting idea. But the fact of the matter is that from a free market point of view, none of it makes any sense. But of course, once if you're a bust bank, it doesn't matter. The free market goes out of the window if you're a bust bank or a nuclear industry. You just present your bill to the government.
Okay, you touched briefly on Germany. And BMW's family donation to Angela Merkel's party is stoking a massive lobbying row over in Germany. I mean, I don't think it's quite been heard so loud here, but German opposition parties on Tuesday accused Angela Merkel of pandering to the car lobby after her conservatives, I think it's a Christian Democrat party, received major donations from the family that controls BMW, just as Berlin was lobbying against tougher EU caps on carbon emissions. They said the three donations made on October the 9th, totaling €700,000, have no connection to any political decisions. But the funds came days before European Union environment ministers backed German demands to scrap a deal to cap EU car emissions that Berlin had argued would cost jobs and damage its premium automakers.
Well, you've summed it up nicely. So the this is a very long-running story, actually, Tony, which has been playing out before the German election, clearly during it, and now after it as well. What's going on is that there are existing targets at the European level to make cars greener. By greener, I mean more fuel efficient. I mean, essentially, if you're cutting the carbon out of cars, what you're doing is making them run faster for less money. So it's in the consumer's interest. It's one of the reasons why the price of running a car is not going up as steeply as the price of petrol, because cars are getting more efficient and people are switching to more fuel efficient cars, and there's a massive incentive to do that, and it's generally a good news story. And it's required, it was regulation that by 2015 meant they had to cut the average emissions of cars to, I think, about 60 miles per gallon. That's about the average efficiency. It's been rumbling on for ages, and they were trying to work out what to do next. And by 2020 the plan was that cars would be down, the average of any fleet would be down to about 40 miles per gallon across the whole of Europe. And the Germans essentially did not want to do this, because they, what Germans make, as anyone knows, are, they make Daimlers, Mercedes, BMW, They make big cars. Not exclusively, right? But they make big cars. The average of all your fleet has to be at a particularly low carbon emissions. That means basically you can't sell those big cars unless those cars get massively more fuel efficient. Just under 1 million people in Germany work in the car industry. Apparently, I was reading in the FT, one out of every 7 university graduates goes to work in the car industry over there. Clearly, as you've just pointed out, there is a huge... the car industry has enormous political weight as a result. This donation is exceptionally fishy. I think even apart from this donation, it's clear which side the Chancellor's bread, the German Chancellor's bread was buttered on. And there was all sorts of rumours about stuff going on when this was first discussed in Europe in June, about threats being made to countries like Hungary and Slovakia by the Germans, that they would pull out their manufacturing plants, because of course a lot of the manufacturing doesn't happen in Germany. The companies may be German, but the manufacturing doesn't. Rumours of calls to David Cameron saying that Germany would support what Cameron wants to do with banking legislation, i.e. essentially about bankers' bonuses and stopping caps on bankers' bonuses. Calls to the Irish Prime Minister, who was hosting the talks, to just say, come on, Ender, you know, let's not be doing any of this nonsense. And to cut a very long story shorter than I already haven't, the deal, it was announced this week that Germany, a deal has been struck that this new, tighter car efficiency standard won't happen. And as you say, it all seems to follow on very neatly from a campaign of lobbying before the German election and after it.
Well, I mean, the donations, this 700,000 euro donation to Merkel's party came from Joanna Quant, the widow of industrialist Herbert Quant, who's credited with transforming BMW after World War II. But it's a very controversial family because they made their money during World War II, this family, making batteries for the Nazi war effort and supplying them to aircraft, to submarines, to warships, etc. And also just transferred their money out of that firm, the battery firm, and bought up this private company, BMW. So you can't buy shares in BMW. It's a very private firm owned by this very private family. And also when there was a commission set up to redistribute profits from World War II, after World War II, to victims of the Holocaust and victims of concentration camps, labour camps, and this kind of thing, BMW actually refused to contribute to it, even though the other companies who had been involved, for example Volkswagen, were manufacturing the V1 flying bombs, the old doodle bugs, this kind of thing. They all fessed up, put their hands in the air and said, well, we should contribute to that fund, not BMW. Martin, the power of the motor industry, it seems to be tied in, doesn't it, with the power of the oil industry around the world, and actually far more powerful in this case, it seems, here than governments.
Well, yes, I mean, that is true. And also, I was reading this morning that scientists have now discovered that air pollution is, in fact, a major cause of cancer. And I think there's a general consensus emerging around this. So we're not, this isn't a trivial matter. We're actually, lung cancer is very definitely being caused by emissions. And if we're talking about saving energy, we should surely be making cars as efficient as we possibly can. I mean, that's what happened in the 70s with the first oil price shock. The Japanese and the Germans were much, much quicker on the uptake than everybody else, and they started to develop the modern-looking car, which actually goes, many, many more miles to the gallon than the gas guzzlers. I mean, it's so obvious. We used to talk about this as just never inevitably going to happen, and yet we've still got these huge, monstrous cars on the road. What are they doing there?
I mean, this is the advantage, of course, they use more fuel, and so the oil companies...
Well, exactly, and we all know what to... I mean, and if we're talking about reducing energy use, I mean, that is ultimately the game we need to be getting into. I've just been reading this very interesting book about social development over the centuries and energy capture. And we're now each human being is now using far more energy than we were even 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and certainly more than we were 100 years ago. Now, we can't go on down that road. We've got to start using less... That doesn't mean we have to make our lifestyle less... satisfactory. We just have to get more efficient at using fossil... We will carry on using fossil fuels. I'm sure we will still be using coal in 200 years' time, but we won't be using very much of it.
Well, we were hooked on it while it was cheap, weren't we? Anyway, this... looking into the future a little bit, Greenpeace, yes, I know it's not Friends of the Earth that have come up with this, David, but landowners, they say, can work together to block fracking by trespass. And this is Jonathan Brown in The Independent. Householders are being urged to block plans for wide-scale fracking in Britain by denying permission for drilling companies to extract oil and gas from underneath their homes. Environmental group Greenpeace is calling on local residents who oppose shale gas or oil exploitation near them to join together to assert what they claim are common law rights to forbid the trespass of energy firms from conducting activities below their property. Now, is this a runner? It was something that apparently was successfully done by Mohamed El Fayed in a court case last year.
Is that right? Well, I don't. As you pointed out, it's a Greenpeace court case. Good luck to him. I mean, it sounds like a really interesting line of approach. I don't know enough about the legalities of whether it's possible. It sounds like I know Greenpeace well enough that they wouldn't have asserted that you have the rights to the stuff underground if you didn't. So let's assume that there's something in that. I think this is actually, following on from the story before, this is quite an interesting example of where a company is not getting its own way at all, actually. If you look at the fracking industry, you look at Quadrilla, what they've wanted to do down in Bulkham, and the massive amount of protests that's been going on down there. I don't think people particularly want to see fracking. I don't think they want to see it because they don't want all the lorries coming into their community. I actually genuinely think that if you said to people, would you rather have a nice renewable scheme that you benefit from, or do you want to have your village fracked? I think I know which way they would go, and the protests bear that out. So I think this is just another one of the many, many reasons why fracking is not going to be the silver bullet, the new North Sea dash for oil and gas that George Osborne wants it to be. He wants to have his Margaret Thatcher moment. He wants to unleash a new form of energy for the UK economy. It doesn't really matter to him that that's high carbon. And that's what he wants to see happening. But not only will it not bring down your bills, and all the evidence shows that, but I don't think people want it.
Okay, David, how do people follow what Friends of the Earth are up to and join, even, if they feel like it?
Yeah, best thing to do, if you're online, go to our website. You can either Google Friends of the Earth, or it's foe.co.uk,
or you can... Your other search engine, not necessarily Google.
Yeah, other search engines are apparently
they
available.
Do work.
Yeah, they do work. Or you can give us a call. Call our switchboard, 0207 490 1555.
Okay. David Powell, Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we've had quite a lot of discussion again about the Edward Snowden revelations this week. A bit of a Barney the week before last, and even more of one this week, with The Guardian sort of battling away to say that it is actually working in the public interest, whereas David Cameron is saying he wants The Guardian investigated.
Well, he also, Cameron was behind the raid on The Guardian's offices, where they destroyed the hard drive which had all the information that they've been using on. And Russ Bridger, who's the editor of The Guardian, saying, well, this is a bit silly, because in actual fact we've got copies of this outside the country. So destroying this hard drive to keep the Americans happy is just a pointless act of bullying.
Well, this little incident was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions this week, and guess who it was that brought it up? It was our favourite MP from North Somerset, Liam Fox, the guy that got dismissed from his job because he'd been having this little relationship with a guy called Adam Werety, even though he wasn't supposed to, allowing this guy to go around pretending that he was working for the government when he wasn't. So let's hear from Liam Fox now at Prime Minister's Questions.
Dr. Liam Fox.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, can we have a full and transparent assessment about whether the Guardian's involvement in the Snowden affair has damaged Britain's national security? And does my right honourable friend agree that it's bizarre that from some the hacking of a celebrity phone demands a prosecution, but leaving the British people and our security personnel more vulnerable is opening a debate?
Well, I commend my right honourable friend for raising this issue. I think the plain fact is that what has happened has damaged national security, and in many ways the Guardian themselves admitted that when they agreed, when asked politely by my National Security Advisor and Cabinet Secretary to destroy the files they had, they went ahead and destroyed those files. So they know that what they're dealing with is dangerous for national security. I think it's up to select committees in this House if they want to examine this issue and make further recommendations.
Well, dangerous for national security.
Well, that's patently rubbish. In actual fact, as Nick Brown pointed out this week, the former Labour minister, that what the NSA and GCHQ are doing, or GCHQ particularly in Britain, is exactly what was going to be what the government was going to pass through in this so-called Snoopers Charter that the Liberal Democrats said, no, that's too extreme. We can't be checking everybody's emails and so on. And it turns out that that's what they've been doing all along. Now, I'll make a simple logical point. That activities by GCHQ has no legal basis and is therefore illegal. So the people in GCHQ who have been in charge of doing all of this stuff without control of Parliament are in fact in breach of the law, should be prosecuted and sent to prison. That is the reality of the situation. And saying that national security, when we find out, for example, that the government is carrying out murders or massacres or something of that sort, as has happened in Italy in the past, is it in the public interest for people to find out about that? It very definitely is. GCHQ have been breaking British law. And that's as simple as that.
Another thing in The Guardian this week, GCHQ accused of monitoring privileged emails between lawyers and clients.
That is also illegal. Now, if we're going to send people to prison for a year and a half for stealing a bottle of water when they break the law, what are we going to do with those in authority who are well paid and extremely privileged when they break the law? And that means GCHQ have been breaking the law. All the people involved should be prosecuted and sent to prison.
A former senior intelligence official has questioned the impartiality of the committee which scrutinises Britain's security service, that is the Intelligence and Security Committee. Sir Francis Richards said it was not a very good idea for an ex-Conservative minister to head Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee. That's Sir Malcolm Rifkind.
Well, I mean, we need to have proper oversight of our security
but
services.
But why is he saying that? I mean, why is it... I mean, he does actually explain that he thinks that actually it should be someone from the opposition party.
Yes, well, I think that's Hazel Blears has said something similar this week. I mean, in other words, we need to know who guards the Guardians. Now, it's quite obvious a secret service has to be secret.
I mean, for the police, for example, in the Home Affairs Select Committee, is Keith Vaz oversees that, who's a Labour MP.
What I would suggest is that the intelligence services have to work within the law. And in actual fact, NATO intelligence services have a track record of fomenting terrorism. We could go into the details about that, but it's certainly true in Italy, Belgium and other places. People only need to go and use their favourite search engine and look up Gladio and they will see what has been happening. It's not just that they're spying on people. There is suspicion that NATO intelligence services are involved in terrorism. That means they need to be investigated by the civilian police force, and if they are being shown to break the law, and that includes snooping and other things of that sort, but if they've been shown, for example, to be fomenting such things as Islamist terrorism, they need to be prosecuted, well, arrested and sent to prison. We need a rule of law here.
The former Cabinet Minister Chris Huhne is saying that the Cabinet was told nothing about the GCHQ spying programmes, that's Tempora and PRISM, at all. Neither, because he was on the National Security Council, neither was the National Security Council told about these spying programmes. And that's from someone who was right in the middle of it all.
Well, in the US, even very right-wing politicians are saying this will not do. You can't be spying on everybody's emails. I think people have got to I mean, I think the general view in Britain is, of course, they're spying on everybody's emails. Does it matter? Well, it doesn't matter that much unless, in actual fact, the intelligence services are also involved in fomenting terrorism.
Well, the trouble is, of course,
the other point is
Martin,
that there's no legal basis for any of this.
The other thing is there's actually quite a lot of pressure for them to be selling this information on. This is a problem. Mm. Is for them to become more commercial. And in fact, back in 1999, MI6 held a big bun fest in London, inviting companies, saying, you know, how can we sell information to you? Mm. So one wonders where this information is.
Well,
being
as
sold.
Edward Snowden pointed out, a lot of emails which have been intercepted in the US have been passed straight over to the Israeli intelligence services. Now, people in Britain may be happy for the British intelligence services to look at their emails. Are you that happy for the Israeli intelligence services to look at your emails? Just think of the power the Israeli intelligence services get through doing that. Now, what we've actually got is an out of control military industrial complex based in the US with lots of links in Israel and Britain, in which no politicians are allowed to know what's going on at all. So the intelligence services are listening to the emails, for example, or covering the emails of all the politicians. They find out what all the politicians are up to. Can people see what's wrong with that? That the intelligence services have got dirt on all the politicians? Why do you think they're doing that?
Okay.
It's because they've got an agenda of their own.
Sir Malcolm Rifkin's firm, LEK Consulting, he's the guy who's supposed to oversee all this for us, brings considerable experience and commercial expertise helping defence sector firms in military aerospace, satellite and missile systems, security systems integration and electronic warfare. Now, is he the right guy to be overseeing it? I mean, I wonder, I mean, if he's being paid and he's part of the defence industry, if he really is the right person to be making sure that the public is being served by these organisations rather than that they're simply in bed with the defence industry.
Well, that's what it looks like, doesn't it? I mean, basically, Malcolm Rifkind is in their pocket and is a person that personally profiting from the military-industrial complex. I don't think those people should be in charge of supervising what their activities are at all.
Well, they're actually coming out with something saying that Malcolm Rifkind is going to be supervising an inquiry into all of this.
Well, he's not a suitable person to be doing it. It's a fox in charge of the hen house, isn't it?
Anyway, also this week, Edward Snowden, in fact, I think it was last weekend, had something to say for the first time I've heard him for a little while. So let's have a listen to Edward Snowden speaking in Moscow, an award ceremony that he was handed an award.
People all over the world are realizing that these programs don't make us more safe. They hurt our economy. They hurt our country. They limit our ability to speak and think and live and be creative, to have relationships, to associate freely. And they're going, this doesn't make us more safe. It makes us less safe. It puts us at risk of coming into conflict with our own government. And there's a far cry between legal programs, legitimate spying, legitimate law enforcement, where it's targeted, it's based on reasonable suspicion, an individualized suspicion, and a warranted action, and sort of dragnet mass surveillance that puts entire populations under sort of an eye that sees everything, even when it's not needed.
Sees everything even when it's not needed.
Well, that's even worse than that. If you think that in actual fact, in many terrorism cases, the intelligence services are suspects. I'm not saying that all terrorism is fomented by the intelligence services, but a very large proportion of it is. And that's historically documented. Look up Gladio if you don't believe me. Now, do you want the people who are the terrorists to be able to look at your emails? And look at imagine what the power that gives the new Stasi, if they can look at the emails of all politicians, for example, the politicians that might call them to account. They could tap them on the shoulder and say, do you want people to find out about your extramarital affair? That's what we're dealing with here.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
And now on to the suspicious death of Michael Hastings. And I'm going to hear from him now. He's a US investigative journalist, won several awards, and he got the Afghanistan boss, the general in charge of the US troops in Afghanistan, sacked, Martin. I mean, by an article that he wrote, really, which was showing that McChrystal was being very disrespectful to Obama. Obama then sacked him. Yeah. Anyway, Michael Hastings died in a rather nasty, fiery car crash in Los Angeles back in June. So I thought I'd trawl the internet a little bit and find out who he was. So let's have a listen to him now, talking a bit earlier this year, and he's talking about how the press corps actually, rather than working for the public, tends to work for the Pentagon.
It's got a good amount of publicity, building momentum, but not too many people outside of this long, Glenn Greenwald or others, have sort of really picked out on this line. We have the Pentagon spokesperson, which General McChrystal was, at the time of the invasion of Iraq, telling me, we totally co-opted the media on that one. Some of us didn't think it was a good idea. And then he went through a list of all these journalists who he felt were co-opted. These are big-time, well-paid, well-represented, they have tons of audience, and he was telling me that they were co-opted the media. And when the Pentagon spokesperson saying that, and we saw the former White House spokesperson Scott McClellan say that, and a lot of other journalists are saying, a lot of other journalists sort of outside that mainstream element are saying that, I think one has to really look at what we've been doing the past 10 years. I think the invasion of Iraq is the great journalistic sort of scandal of our lifetimes. Hopefully it will be of our lifetimes. I don't think the country could take much more than that. And the question is, have we learned from that? And sadly, I don't know if we have.
An honest account. You didn't try to protect McChrystal or the aides that surrounded him. And then you got really crazy backlash.
I was shocked that I was shocked that President Obama fired him. I think that was very significant. I did not realize how bad the relationship between the president and the Pentagon had been. And I think what that meant was this was President Obama reasserting his control over the Pentagon. So yeah, I was shocked on that front. I was also surprised by the media's response. And it was a portion of the media, the Pentagon media, the national security media. And at first I was sort of confused about it. And I was like, well, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They don't really mean what they're saying about the story. But then as months and months went on, I'd get along fine with different government officials for the most part, but there was still this really intense, you know, hatred among a few of my colleagues. And I think in the sort of insight I had, or what I kind of realized, was that the Pentagon press corps is just that. They're the press corps for the Pentagon. And I know that sounds overstated.
Well, they serve the Pentagon, and they're scared to hurt the feelings, you could say, or step on the toes of the Pentagon.
Right. Look, you know, there was a Pentagon spokesperson, a guy by the name of Jeff Morrell. And now you knew Jeff Morrell was telling the truth because he'd start to sweat, because he'd be lying all the other time. And I listened to a radio show, and it's like Jeff Morrell and reporter from X mainstream publication, and I'm not going to mention, and they sound the same, you know, and they're complimenting each other and saying what great jobs they're both doing. And look, like, if that's what you want to do, you know, I'm all for it. I understand there's a lot of different
pressures.
But
does that keep the war going? Does that keep the public completely in the dark about what's going on in the war?
the president was coming in to trying to take over the Pentagon, didn't realize how much resistance he would face. And I think when the brass saw weakness, they took advantage of it. They took advantage of it in a major way. And 9 months later, after that meeting, when General Petraeus and General McChrystal wanted more troops, how did they get it? They went to the media. They leaked to the media. They said to the media, if we don't get these troops, we're going to resign. That's very significant because it boxes the president in and says, okay, you want to take us on, you're going to have to suffer the political consequences for it. One of the sort of scary realizations I had while reporting this book, and it came to me at the end, was that I asked myself the question, even if President Obama wanted to start these wars, give me the benefit of the doubt, could he stop it? Could he have done it? Is it even possible for the president to get a handle on this massive military bureaucracy? 54% of our federal tax dollars go to the Pentagon. There's more employees in the Pentagon than there are in the states of Vermont, Wyoming, and probably even Rhode Island. There's 3.2 million employees in the Pentagon. It's such a huge, it's almost the 51st state. It's such a huge challenge for any president, especially a young president, especially a president with no military experience. And what really came to mind was John F. Kennedy had a similar experience with the Bay of Pigs, where the generals in the CIA took advantage of him, they pulled him into something he didn't want to do, and afterwards he said those SOBs just sat there nodding with all the fruit salad on their chest, giving me bad advice, saying it would work. And Kennedy learned the hard lesson, and Kennedy was a war hero too, so he had more advantage of it, more sort of understanding of it. And I think it was a lesson that President Obama has learned.
So that was the very fast-talking, highly intelligent, award-winning investigative journalist Michael Hastings. Martin, the questions about the crash are largely to do with a friend of his who he called into the night before the crash, and that was on Tuesday the 18th of June this year, and he said that he thought his car, his Mercedes, was being tampered with. Mm-hmm. And he asked to borrow her Volvo. She actually was having trouble with her car too, so she didn't. And then when he drove off from there, that was when the car took off at 70 miles an hour. One of the most suspicious things about it is one of the police cameras shows that whilst he was flying past a police car about 70 miles an hour in Los Angeles, he had his foot hard down on the brake.
Yes, and then he died in the car crash, but the suspicion is, even in mainstream circles in America, the suspicion is that he has been murdered by the Pentagon. That's got to be the police, if you were a police officer investigating it, that's what you've got to presume is going on. And we were talking earlier, is it okay for the Pentagon to listen to everybody's phone calls? Well, if they're going around murdering people, the answer is no. And can I just mention that Seymour Hersh, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, everything he says, all journalists in America know exactly who he is and how reliable he is. He says the story about the assassination of bin Laden in Pakistan is a pack of lies. Now, do people want to hear the truth, that the government is lying to them about all of this? Or do they want to stick their finger in their ears and go la 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 and wait for World War III? I think not.
Well, let's hear a little bit more now from Michael Hastings.
An information operations cell, which is a cell that by definition is trained to conduct psychological operations and military deception, was asked by Lieutenant General Caldwell and his staff to use their skills on visiting U.S. senators and other VIPs. Now, the cell, this I.O. cell, was led by a gentleman named Lieutenant Colonel Michael Holmes. Lieutenant Colonel Holmes raised objections to being asked to do this. He said, hey, I'm an I.O. cell. Information operations is only supposed to be used for foreign audiences. It's a really bad idea to be using my team, because we specialize in psychological operations and whatnot, to be doing this. But the pressure kept on mounting on him to focus all his efforts not on the Afghans but on Americans visiting. Finally, he received a written order to this effect: focus all your efforts on essentially manipulating visiting senators. He then took that order and went to a lawyer, a JAG lawyer. The lawyer said, "Yes, this is not right. This is illegal." Another lawyer confirmed that opinion, and then Caldwell's people refined the order to say, oh, well, you're only looking at public records. But then they launched a retaliatory investigation into the whistleblower, Colonel Michael Holmes. And after he tried to get his complaints redressed and said, hey, I was attacked because I'm a whistleblower, I was investigated because I'm a whistleblower, that also had no impact. And so eventually he decided to go public with his story.
Michael Hastings there, who died early this year. Martin, what he's talking about there is actually using the National Security Agents basically against your political opponents, isn't he?
Well, it's not using it. If the politicians are blackmailed by the security chiefs, you then wonder whether you've got a democracy at all. Think Russia. Think the FSB. is Russia a democracy? Is the US a democracy? Is Britain a democracy if the security services have all the power?
Former counterterrorism official Richard Clark spoke in an interview to the Huffington Post saying, look, he said, it is possible for intelligence agencies to seize control of a car remotely. That's what he claims, and to do what they want to it. And he went on to say, my rule has always been you don't knock down a conspiracy theory until you can prove it wrong.
Obama has enshrined the two most radical principles of the Bush Doctrine. The first is, he got rid of torture and sort of got rid of extraordinary rendition, but enshrines targeted assassination. At the same time, he won't apologize for the scandal in Benghazi. He won't apologize for the IRS, a few bad apples. And he says, no, the AP and spying on journalists is okay. So he enshrines killing people and spying on journalists as the two major tenets of his national security state. I think this is outrageous.
The Obama administration has clearly declared war on the press. It's declared war on investigative journalists, our sources. I think the only recourse to this kind of behavior by the government is to say back to the government, we declare war on you, and from this point forward, we should no longer, as a media, as a whole, cooperate in any manner with the government in terms of when we're doing national security stories. We should withdraw all our cooperation, and we should publish everything we know, because it's a free press, and it's not a free except for when the government tells me to do it press. We've been way too easy going with these guys. We've let them get away with this for years. We've let them tell us what to print, what not to print, and I say be done with it, and everybody should just get together and fire back, because no one else is going to defend the press.
That was the voice of Michael Hastings, investigative journalist in the United States working for Rolling Stone magazine and others, BuzzFeed as well, who died earlier this year in suspicious circumstances in Mercedes in Los Angeles. Martin, he said that he was looking into something very hot and he was going to have to go under the radar possibly. His wife has said that was Brennan, the new CIA director, Brennan, starting to use the Central Intelligence apparatus against political opponent, the military, US military's political opponents domestically, and that's why he's there. Really, I think at least possibly that's one of the reasons he's there, saying that the press needs to declare war back, because actually what's happened is the national security agencies have declared war on the public through the press and particularly investigative journalists.
Well, again, people can just do a search and look up COINTELPRO, counterintelligence propaganda, run by the FBI in the 1980s. It's all on the record. Basically, the intelligence services in this country as well. I mean, we've found that the police have been cooperating with the blacklisting of trade unionists. The activists have always known that the security services are basically corrupt, and they have been for a long time. And when journalists speak out like Michael Hastings, our suspicion is that this chap was murdered. Now, if you think it's okay for the intelligence services to listen to everybody's phone calls when they're going around murdering journalists, then I have a totalitarian state to sell you.
Finally, Michael's book is The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. That's Michael Hastings, the most impact-laden story of the year, says Vanity Fair, and that is available at the moment in paperback for something like £5-6 if you want to have a read of Michael's final book.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
And now, a much lighter subject, this is turning office buildings into homes, AEOB, House People. What does that stand for, David Mowat?
Empty office blocks. Hi, Tony.
Oh, fine. Okay, so what's the plan?
The plan is to raise as much money as possible through a community share offer. We're in the middle of that now. And buy somewhere in the centre of Bristol or in the sort of inner city areas and demonstrate that citizens, people and their money can help create a model social housing and affordable housing community, and thereby leverage the people with the power to do this on a bigger scale.
Well, it's a great vision, but not easy to get the money, I would imagine. What problems are you running into?
Some of us want to move fast. Some of us are more cautious. That's one issue. There's one site that we looked at was sold to the highest bidder. It was too expensive. That was the De Courcy House, you know, the probation building in Brunswick Square. We even had draft plans laid out for how that would be changed. And more recently, a site we've looked at has proven to be ridden by Japanese knotweed. So we don't want to touch that. So, you know, it's all fun and games. We're very determined and confident.
I mean, you're trying to do this in the middle of an asset bubble, Martin. I mean, they're trying to buy an office building when actually the prices are overinflated. And is that fair to say?
Well, I mean, they are trying to do, as private citizens, what bigger boys need to be taking responsibility for this.
But you're meeting this week on Thursday evening at St Stephen's Church. What's the idea behind that, David?
The idea behind this meeting is that we're not... A traditional model would be that sort of experts and financiers and professionals would get together, do all the legwork, and then... At some point when there was a finished product, we let it out to tenants. We don't want to do it that way. We think community is only built when the people who need housing, want housing, who are currently in insecure housing, get together and start to design the place, set the terms, and that's what's happening this Thursday.
Okay, so what's the time? St Stephen's is just off the centre, isn't it? Near the War Memorial, right in the city centre.
That's right. St Stephen's is just off Corn Street on St Stephen's Avenue. 21 St Stephen's Street. There's two parallel streets.
But what time?
It's at 6:30.
And what can people expect?
People can expect a visioning exercise whereby together we decide what kind of communities that we want to create.
And I think the idea there is that some people might be going fast, some people slow. And interesting. And also, I imagine, if people are going to be living quite close together, some people may prefer to live with other people.
Yes, so we want all kinds of people to come together. Old, young, maybe relatively wealthier people who can buy their unit, as well as people...
A bit of everything. Anyway, so that's... time again is...
6:30
at St Stephen's on Thursday evening. Time to sign off now. Next is Cyrus the Virus. Next week, the great land debate. Is Britain still a feudal country? I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at
thisweek.co.uk.
Sorry, thisweek.org.uk. See you next
online
week.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.